All right.
The court will now call Joel Sandbrook versus Texas Christian University. May it please the court, Mr. Justin Sumner will argue for the appellant. Mr. Nicholas Bedinger will argue for the appellee.
Good afternoon. And may it please the court, my name is Justin Sumner and I represent the appellant Joel Stainbrook. This has been quite a journey. I want to thank you for granting appellant's request for oral argument. There are two issues on appeal in this matter. The first issue is whether the trial court committed error by granting TCU's no evidence motion for summary judgment, and also whether or not the trial court erred by failing to follow Tarrant County Local Rule 1.03 for transferred cases. The summary of the argument, the only dispositive motion TCU chose to file in this matter was a no evidence motion for summary judgment. As the court's well aware, had TCU chosen to file a traditional motion, certainly dueling testimony would have been permitted. That's not the vehicle TCU chose. Therefore, Stainbrook only had the burden of presenting more than a scintilla of evidence in this matter on each element to survive the no evidence motion for summary judgment. In fact, Stainbrook presented more by leaps and bounds in this case. It presented 63 bullet points of evidence, testimony, and evidence as to why TCU had a duty to take reasonable precautions to protect Stainbrook as an invitee in this premises liability case. On the trial court level, TCU argued and presented controverting facts and evidence, which was appropriate for a jury to decide and not for the court for purposes of no evidence of the no evidence motion. The fact that TCU argued facts and submitted competing evidence by its very nature created a fact question appropriate for the jury. To do a quick factual background, this case is centered around the highest attended football game in TCU's history as of this date. The date of this game was November 14th, 2009. It was Utah versus TCU. There were 50,306 people in attendance for this particular exceptional game. On this date, my client was assaulted on TCU's campus in tailgate lot number two, which holds approximately 475 cars. This lot runs directly adjacent to the stadium. It's arguably the largest, highest capacity lot on campus, and ultimately my client was caused to have a metal rod permanently implanted in his leg as a result of the assault. So the court has an understanding of the magnitude of this game. Both teams were nationally ranked in the top 20. TCU sent out an email prior to this game to invitee ticket purchasers such as my client, stating that it was a sellout. It was expecting an overflow crowd for this game. This game was nationally televised, and it was also the first time in TCU's history that ESPN Game Day was broadcasting from campus. This was an exceptional game compared to other games that had ever been held at TCU, and TCU was well aware of this. Therefore, as a result of ESPN Game Day broadcasting from campus that morning, the gates were actually opened early for the tailgating areas. So invitees were allowed to come onto campus earlier, began consuming alcohol earlier. It was a night game, so it was 6:30 p.m. kickoff, and the game didn't end until 10:10 p.m. that night. So it was a long day of alcohol consumption. There were two groups involved in this altercation. There was a tailgating group, which Mr. Stainbrook, my client, was a part of, and then you have the O'Brien brothers. There were three brothers who were causing problems that day. In cutting out a lot of the facts, all the evidence reveals that the O'Briens were noticeably and visibly intoxicated by several witnesses. There's evidence there was an incident before the game where security was called. There's an incident after the game at approximately 11:15 p.m. where security was called. And then there was the final assault at approximately 11:45 p.m.
Well, my reading of the facts was that there was one lady, one girl, that said there's something occurred before the game started. There was something that occurred about 30 minutes after Mr. Stainbrook returned to the tailgate party at the end of the third quarter. There was another incident 30 to 60 minutes after the game ended, and there was the final incident when they snuck back onto the lot. So I read that there were four incidents. Now maybe I'm not – maybe the second and the third one are the same one, but
– They could have been, Your Honor, and I think there was some alcohol consumption involved, and some of the witness testimony varied. We had – the way I've understood it from taking the depositions and from the witness testimony is there was an incident before the game. There was an incident at approximately 11:15 p.m., and then there was an incident, the final assault, is the way I've understood it.
Well, will it – Mr. Becker can straighten me out there. All right.
So the court understands for this game, TCU had three different security entities working the event. You had TCU Police Department, hired Fort Worth police officers, and then you had CSC event staff who are the – you see at sporting events, the yellow jackets, they're recognized. They oftentimes have the word security across their back. You'll see them around football games or basketball courts. Sergeant Stripmatter, the head of bike security in the parking lot area since 1988, testified that tailgaters were allowed to tailgate an hour and a half to sometimes 2 hours after the game ended.
Let me ask this. Are you hanging your hat on Timberwalk history of incidents, or are you hanging your hat on Del Lago? They should have known because what was going on right then?
Well, Your Honor, I believe we presented a scintilla of evidence on both. I believe we can show the testimony revealed 1 to 2 arrests for assault of incidences before previously. They've also, the evidence presented alcohol-related offenses and arrests.
Okay, 1 to 2 offenses, and I read about generally TCU is a sedate crowd, and I wasn't picking up that there was scintilla of history of criminal activity combined with however many hundreds of officers and CSC people there were there that one would lead to believe this was going to occur or was reasonably foreseeable this was going to occur.
Okay.
As opposed to there had been either 2 or 3 incidents immediately before the incident where we have drunken behavior by the O'Brien brothers.
Okay. Well, and my contention, I guess, per Timberwalk, is there were previous incidences, and when you look at the facts of this particular game and the magnitude of this game and the fact that there was no security at all assigned to patrol Lot 2, which, again, is arguably the largest lot adjacent to the stadium.
There was an officer, as I read the testimony, who was there at the gate, and his duties were also to police the parking lot. Plus, there were 10 bike riding officers that patrolled all the lots. And in fact, when the final incident occurred, there were 2 bike officers that were there almost immediately and 1 or 2 other officers that were almost there immediately. So it isn't like everybody's on the other side of the stadium or something.
Well, the testimony showed that none of the officers were in Lot 2 when the incident occurred. The testimony showed that even though there was this was an overflow crowd, this was a sold-out crowd, the one officer who was assigned at the gate testified that he was allowed to leave at 10:30 to 10:45 p.m. The game didn't end until 10:10. Sergeant Stripmatter testified you're allowed to tailgate and drink alcohol for an hour and a half to 2 hours after the game.
I think what they said was that the tailgating usually ended an hour to an hour and a half after the game.
It said an hour and a half to 2 hours after the game.
Okay.
Was his testimony.
That it usually ended, not you were allowed to drink.
I can get his testimony.
Okay, go ahead.
But he testified that tailgating was allowed to occur an hour and a half to 2 hours after the game. The evidence here, just from a Timberwalk perspective, shows that there was no security whatsoever after 10:45 p.m. for this game. Now, from a Del Lago, and I'll jump ahead here. From a Del Lago standpoint, you have this first altercation before the game, which Jenny Robertson, a TCU employee, testified She testified, she's one of the only ones who testified having not consumed any alcohol at all that day. And she testified that the O'Briens were obviously intoxicated, trying to start a fight, and a group of officers arrived before the game. The second altercation after the game, when the O'Briens came back, an analogous to Del Lago, this time it escalated. There was chest bumping, fist clenched, a threat of an altercation.
These officers that kept showing up, they were all Fort Worth police officers, weren't they?
We don't know, absolutely, whether or not they were. I believe the evidence showed they were hired Fort Worth police officers that TCU hired as off-duty officers.
So you're trying to attribute liability to TCU because they hired Fort Worth police officers?
Well, what Del Lago says, what Del Lago ultimately held is once the premises owner has knowledge of a dangerous condition on his campus.
How do you say that TCU had knowledge of these incidences? Because of the radio, sharing some band on the radio?
Well, absolutely. From a Del Lago standpoint, Jared Bradley reported the incident to the officer, witnessed him get on his radio, and...
But he doesn't know who he was talking to or who heard whatever transmission may have taken place, does he?
Well, Officer Brashear testified that it's actually that communication goes to TCU's coordinators. And TCU coordinators who exercise control, who have the power of control or expulsion on their own campus, they then radio out and assign officers where to go. And so TCU claiming they had no knowledge just because they were Fort Worth police officers, they're on the same radio frequency. A call was made. There's evidence, a scintilla of evidence.
Is that some of the evidence that you continue to cite to throughout your briefing, that in fact objections were sustained by the trial court, thereby misleading this court into believing that there's evidence there that was in fact sustained by the trial court?
The trial court sustained, and I argued in my appellate brief, on page 50 of my appellate brief, that the trial court erred by granting an eyewitness account of an officer witnessing an officer get on his radio.
You're saying you raised that as an issue on appeal that the trial court erred in sustaining the objection. You gave us authority and argument, which the appellate rules require, to sufficiently raise that issue.
I believe I did, Your Honor.
Okay, I want you during the break to show me exactly where you did that when you come back up for your rebuttal.
Okay, I will. So,
Mr. Farmer, I'd like to get you to help me with your analysis to Del Lago. It's an interesting case. All 51 pages of it, and six of the judges agreed with the majority opinion, and it appeared to me that the circumstances in terms of the analysis made are significantly different on the facts from what occurred here at TCU. One thing I'd like to be careful that you are in agreement with what I understand the record to be, and that is when the O'Brien brothers were out there attempting to start a fight at the point in time when I think you said was something like 10-10 or something like that, then at that point in time they were actually escorted off the premises and off the premise out of the area of a lot too by police officers and had them escorted out the gate.
Well, Your Honor, if I may,
I'm just asking you, do you agree that that happened in your facts?
There's conflicting testimony. Some witnesses said they were escorted out of the gate. Some witnesses said they were escorted just away from the tailgate area.
Okay. Well, at any rate, there was at least some action taken by TCU, independent and different than Del Lago, where what happened that what the Del Lago case developed was 90 minutes of development into an altercation and fight, and what Del Largo did was continue serving liquor as opposed to escorting anybody out until the final fight that occurred on Del Largo was right at 1:30 whenever they tried to finally shut the place down. And those are different, as I see them, in terms of looking at nonfeasance as the basis for the premises liability claim. Nonfeasance meaning you've found it or something that you knew, direct evidence, knowledge, like in Del Argo, or should have known in terms of previous information to try to render this a safe, make this a safe place for invitees. You following me on that?
I am, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
In terms of what TCU did, I mean, even if what the people who took the action were the Fort Worth Police Department, who have been determined in statutory in case law to be different than an employee of TCU, but even if those officers escorted the people causing the altercation to continue or to escalate, were escorted somewhere away from the Barclay spot for the tailgate party, then that's action taken apart and aside and different from what happened in Del Argo.
And I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and I believe that from a Del Largo standpoint, although the facts are not identical to Del Largo, I think that there was enough evidence to show a scintilla comparing Del Largo to survive a no evidence motion for summary judgment. And I think that from a Timberwalk standpoint, the fact that this was a major college football game with alcohol consumption, an exceptional contest, and the fact that TCU took no extra precautionary measures for this particular game, they didn't hire any extra bike patrol.
Okay, Counselor, we're going on. Let's you can continue during your rebuttal. Let's give Mr. Okay. Bettinger an extra 3 minutes to his time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court.
Let's first start off by figuring out how many incidents there were. According to counsel's brief, we know there was some evidence. There was one before the game. His brief starts out and says that Stainbrook returned to the tailgate party at the end of the third quarter and witnessed a Timothy O'Brien and Cortland Kilpatrick incident going on. And then Jared Bradley testified that 30 minutes after the game was over, a conflict was brewing between Timothy O'Brien and Thomas Corley. So to me, that's four incidents, not three.
I think everybody generally agreed it was two incidents, with the one exception that Ms. Robertson, who was the only one out of all the people there who believes she saw a third
right.
incident.
She said one at the beginning, we know there's one at the end, and here's the evidence of two others.
But no one has testified, to my knowledge, that there was four incidents. There was three is the number that Mr. Sumner has always gone by. Two is the number that I've always believed actually occurred, that Ms. Robertson, her recollection
okay.
was
okay. Well, I'm looking
incorrect.
At page 5 and 6 of his brief, so.
Okay. Anyway, the appellant characterizes that three incidents, and I'll address it as three, and if you'd like, I can address it as four. Two separate district court judges looked at the 144 pages of evidence that less what was struck of evidence that Mr. Sumner submitted, and ruled that he had not presented a scintilla, more than a scintilla of evidence.
Did you submit
one or more elements.
Evidence?
Your Honor, yes, I did. Not intended to transform it into a traditional summary judgment. One purpose, essentially the element of whether this was an intervening cause, and that not being something that he would allege, something I would allege, I would need evidence for, but also just to provide factual support. And I don't believe it created a fact issue that would cause a court to need to consider it. I appreciate the fact that the court's very conversant in Timberwalk and Del Largo. A lot of my notes I can disregard on that. I don't think the appellant has shown at all what he needs to show under Timberwalk. He needs to have similarity, recency, proximity, frequency, and publicity. And what he has shown, the evidence he submitted to the court was a police officer saying, or a couple of police officers, one of whom said, as far as alcohol incidents go, there's one, maybe two on average per game. And then another officer said that there have been fights in the past. No specific number. In fact, the officer said he recalled one 7 years earlier that involved a man who came across his ex-wife with another man. He intended to punch the man, and he ducked away and actually punched the wife, and that was the other assault incident. But in no way did he show a consistent pattern of similar incidents that would put TCU on notice that something was going to happen. Not possible, but a criminal act was going to happen. He didn't show any evidence like that. I think that's fairly clear. Specifically, the generality that the police officer spoke of, yeah, we've had some incidents on average. This, no specific incidents, no police reports. You know, a good example of a companion case that shows how difficult it is to show Timberwalk liability would be the Trammell Crow case, as Supreme Court 267 Southwest 3rd 9, 227 crimes involving robbery, assaults, theft, burglary, weapon possession, and vandalism in the 2 years immediately preceding the date this individual was murdered. And they had incident reports, and the court went through the incident reports to determine whether they were similar. And that's how the court found, no, we don't see that these 227 prior crimes could put Trammell Crow on notice that this murder was going to happen. Plaintiff hasn't produced any incident reports to show that similarity, and similarity being the key here. That's how you find out how it was similar, by showing the police reports, giving the facts of the case, not having an officer say, yeah, we've had a couple of alcohol-related incidents. That's not proper Timberwalk evidence. Of the 84 cases that cite to Timberwalk since its 1998 holding, there's maybe a handful that have actually found Timberwalk liability. It's a very difficult standard to meet. But even more difficult to meet is Del Lago. In the Del Lago court, hard to appreciate the opinion and how it was written, because it goes off on a couple of tangents that I don't think were necessary for the ruling. But if you read what they wrote, we have not held that a bar proprietor always or routinely has a duty to protect patrons from other patrons. And we don't hold that today. Nor have we held that a duty to protect the clientele necessarily arises when a patron becomes inebriated, or when words are exchanged between patrons that lead to a fight. And we don't hold today. Very specific on its facts. We do not announce a general rule today. We hold only on these facts, that during these 90 minutes of recurrent hostilities, not intermittent, a duty arose on Del Lago's part to use reasonable care to protect the invitees from imminent assaultive conduct. And that's the best quote to show exactly how narrow this ruling was, is on this record, this sequence of conduct on this night in this bar could foretell this brawl. And that's so important to realize. You have to look at the egregious nature of what went on that evening. 90 minutes, 90 concurrent minutes, not an incident occurred and then everybody went back to status quo and then another incident occurred. It was 90 minutes of ongoing hostilities between 15 people on the one hand and 15 people on the other hand. In contrast to this case, where we, according to the appellant, have a one-sided controversy. We have the three individuals trying to accost one or more individuals from this tailgate party, which, by the way, I do need to correct the record on the facts. The reason the O'Brien brothers were at the tailgate party is David O'Brien was a fraternity brother and good friend of the tailgate hosts. This was a fraternity party. Mr. O'Brien was a member of the fraternity. He graduated the same year as Mr. Bradley and Mr. Brown, and they were good friends. That's why he was there. That's why they were there after the first, or excuse me, 2 hours before the game. That's why they came back after the game. They were essentially welcome. Mr. Brown, in his affidavit submitted by the plaintiff, says, I knew him. He was an acquaintance of mine. I was introduced to his brother that evening. That's why it's accepted that he and his brothers could come to the tailgate party. So it wasn't like they just wandered up upon a bunch of tailgaters and said, we're going to infiltrate this place, take their beer, and start beating up on people. No, it just got out of control, apparently, with one of the brothers maybe drinking too much. I don't know. I wasn't there. but, you know, ultimately led to what Mr. Bradley characterizes as a premeditated and covertly executed attack, not something that just you could watch like you're watching the pot boil. You're not watching this lead up to the crescendo. No, they snuck. They went all the way to their car on the other side of their of campus. They went off the campus around to, you know, it has to be a quarter mile. And I'm just talking from Mr. O'Brien's testimony that's in the record, that he went to get his truck and they drove back. And then, not being seen by the officer who was still at the gate of Lot 2, executed this attack, which, according to Mr. Bradley, was done in a premeditated and covert fashion. They ran at them and just suddenly started attacking them. Why is it not the same as Del Lago? Well, you know, I've gone through a couple of elements, but, you know, essentially we have 15 on 15 in Del Lago, both being aggressive, constant aggressions with each other. But even more, we had 7 Del Lago employees directly witnessing. And the court used, I think it was illustrative, that the court said actual and direct knowledge on the part of the premises, the bar owner. Actual and direct, not just actual, direct knowledge. And it was direct knowledge because you had the 7 bar employees watching this all happen. They watched the pot go from low to low medium to medium to medium high, and they watched it boil over. They essentially made it boil over by taking these 30 people and putting them in the boxing ring together. They funneled them all out the exit at the same time. What's going to happen? Well, of course, there's going to be a melee at that point. What do we have here? When the police officer, not TCU, but when the police officer who showed up at the tailgate party was told what was happening, and according to his testimony, by the way, no crimes were committed in his presence. No crimes at all. If he witnessed a crime, he testified, he would have arrested him. No public intoxication in his impression, and he appraised the situation. He had the ability to arrest because he was there to enforce the laws, not to enforce TCU house rules, which is a big distinction. He's enforcing the laws. He finds no laws being broken. He makes a decision that the game is over. The game's been over for almost an hour and a half, you know, an hour or so. The best thing that can happen here is I just get these guys off premises. And he does so. How is that different than Del Lago? Del Lago, they did nothing. Here, the officer, assuming you're saying that there was a duty first, which we contend there was no duty because of no notice to TCU, but assuming there's even a duty, the officer did something. There was no inaction. There was actual action.
Mr. Badger, I don't read Del Lago to say that they did nothing. What Justice Willett said was that the antagonism may have ebbed and flowed over the 90 minutes, but the liquor simply flowed. They kept serving drinks.
Exactly.
That's not nothing.
They're fueling the fire. The inaction, though, is implicit. It goes on for 90 minutes, and they don't do anything while they're watching it boil over. There's inaction. In this situation, there wasn't a, let's sit around and watch and see if anything else happens. Let's throw them back into the pot and let it boil over. It was, okay, the tailgate host has asked me, a peace officer, to remove these gentlemen. They're no longer welcome at this tailgate party. They've asked me to remove them. I don't see any crimes taking place. The best thing that can occur now, the game is over, everybody's leaving, is I escort these gentlemen off premises. And that's exactly what they did. Which, even if you get to the breach element, I think there's no way plaintiff can eclipse breach when you have the officer escorting the offenders off the premises. So, in sum, you know, you have an indoor bar in Del Lago, which you've got doors, you can send one party or the one group of 15, you can send them out the door, shut and lock the door, and separate. Here you have, you know, 4 or 5 acres of parking lot with multiple ways to enter. Vast difference in the facility itself. You have a two-sided fight versus a one-sided fight. You have 90 minutes versus a 1 or 2 minute, 30 minutes of inactivity, and then a premeditated attack. You have 7 employees in Del Lago directly observing. Here, the best the plaintiff could offer in support of his Del Lago claim was the fact that they have the same radio band. The Southwest Special Events Band is the one they use. So 113 officers speaking on this radio, and plaintiff suggests that means if one officer speaks and says something, that that is notice to TCU. And I say that is insufficient. That is not a scintilla of evidence of notice to TCU. Moreover, we objected because Mr. Bradley's testimony was intended to show what the officer said, that he called other officers. We objected. The court excluded that evidence. There is no evidence in the record as to what was said. We don't know if it was, hey, Brashear, I need somebody to go over to lot two, without any substance as to what the issue is. It very likely was that, if he's wanting one of the officers specifically assigned to lot two to handle the situation, he likely called that officer and said, Officer Brashear, you know, I need you to go to this tailgate party in lot two.
By the way, I misspoke when I said about the second and third incidents. I wasn't reading from his brief. I'm reading from your brief.
Uh-oh.
On page 5 and 6.
Okay. Well, and I think there's just a timing issue on there that they're talking about the same incident.
Well, they're not only talking about timing, they're talking about different individuals who supposedly were involved in
individuals involved. Something. Mr. Kilpatrick, I believe, Mr. Corley, were each involved in an incident.
Cortland Kilpatrick right after the third quarter and Corley right after the game.
I think the way we clarify, to the extent we can clarify, is Mr. Kilpatrick's affidavit is in evidence, which would tell you whether he would obviously say if he was involved in a dispute with the guy, but rather, you know, he identifies just one. He doesn't identify two. But that's what I'll offer on that situation. We moved for no evidence summary judgment on duty, which I believe is the primary issue here. I don't believe under Timberwalk that the plaintiff had provided even a scintilla of evidence on crimes, but also on Del Lago, because we have constructive cases now. Under Del Lago, we have no notice to TCU, absolutely no notice TCU, excuse me, no evidence of notice. We don't have inaction. We have a party doing something, and that is the police officer, which, again, we don't believe that notice to the police officer can be imputed to TCU, that is inconsistent with the law. And then we further moved on breach and proximate cause. And I would just contend that even if you were to get to breach, you cannot find more than a scintilla of evidence that TCU breached a duty that it may owe to the plaintiff. And you have to separate, again, Timberwalk and Del Lago breach. Timberwalk breach would be what should TCU have done based on knowledge that there were one or two alcohol arrests on average per game and one or two fights in the last 7 years. What should TCU do in that instance? Put 25% more officers on staff for this game? That's exactly what they did. Was it because of prior incidents? No, it was because of the estimated attendance for the game. Del Lago breach. Once it is apparent, once they have actual and direct knowledge that the pot is about to boil over, what did TCU do? Did TCU react? Well, if, again, we consider the police officer to be standing in the shoes of TCU, which I don't, and I don't believe this court should put the officer in TCU's shoes, what did the officer do? The officer escorted the individuals out off the premises.
As to your notice argument, I'm assuming that these are on-duty Fort Worth police officers, not off-duty hired Fort Worth police officers by TCU.
They are off-duty hired police
officers. They are. So, well, why would notice to them hired TCU as TCU hired employees not be noticed to TCU?
And I've cited in my brief that Mansfield versus CF Entry, if an officer is performing a public duty such as the enforcement of general laws, the officer's private employer incurs no vicarious responsibility for that officer's acts, even though the employer may have directed the activities. Okay, so I know that's not exactly on point. I would suggest that there's not a case on point, but that's illustrative of the fact that you can't go up the ladder from the officer to TCU on vicarious liability, and I don't think it constitutes notice. But let me ask this question. I'll make this statement. I'm sorry, I'm not going to ask a question. But what would TCU do if the police officer had actually radioed in and talked to somebody at TCU and apprised them of the situation? What would be their duty? To get a police officer, because a law is being broken. So TCU would have a police officer handle the situation. So they've cut out the middleman in that circumstance. We can't second guess what a police officer's decision was that evening. He made the decision that it was the appropriate thing to do to escort them off the premises. And we can't sit here and second guess. My time is up.
All right, thank you. Rebuttal? I'm sure going to start out by answering Justice Gabriel's question.
I'll tell you, I've read page 50.
Yes,
I've read your 8 words in an issue that started on page 4 and doesn't even end on page 50, which was your first issue, which was the trial court erred in granting a motion for no evidence summary judgment. You saying that those 8 words, regardless of the error of the trial court in ruling on a hearsay objection, those 8 words were sufficient to meet TRAP Rule 38.1 on the specificity of an issue, bringing an issue to this court.
Sorry, Your Honor, I'm a little confused as to where you are.
I'm on page 50, which
on
is
page
where
50.
You told me to look.
Yes, Your Honor.
The 8 words I'm talking about are the 8 words that says, regardless of this error by the trial court, where you're talking about the trial court sustained an objection. You're saying those 8 words that are subsumed in at least a 46-page issue is enough to concisely and correctly bring a separate issue to the attention of this court.
It is my understanding, I don't have the law with me on that issue, but I believe that I raised this issue in the argument section of my brief. The officer got on his radio, contacted the other officers, was not hearsay. And I believe the trial court erred by ruling that that it was.
And was that one of your delineated issues in your brief, that the trial court
not separate.
Erred?
No, Your Honor.
So you're saying those 8 words are enough to trigger us in on that?
I'm not sure. You're the judge. I'm not sure. I believed I had raised it. I guess in hindsight, I should have created a totally separate issue. But I thought I had brought it to the attention of the court in the argument section of my brief.
Hey, let me ask this question about the recusal and all that. How were you harmed by the fact that it went back to Cosby instead of going to somebody else or being randomly assigned, since it was eventually assigned to somebody else after the recusal? So how were you harmed?
Well, I think we are harmed because I think the case was tainted at that point. There's a whole history. I think that I don't even know how many hearings we argued, how many we've had to file multiple motions to compel. We had to file spoliation of evidence.
Okay, but those aren't acts of the trial court.
Right.
So I haven't heard harm yet.
Well, I just think I think we were harmed in that just, you know, the local rule wasn't followed. We were sent directly back to the judge who had the case before. I don't know we were necessarily harmed. The rule just wasn't followed.
Okay.
May I respond to Mr. Bettinger quickly?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Again, it's appellate's contention that certainly as far as the timber walk analysis, that we presented a scintilla of evidence to show that TCU was aware and it was foreseeable in a football game environment like this, with one to two evidence of one to two arrests per game, that an incident, another fight just like this could have happened. And it was certainly reasonably foreseeable that it would have happened.
We have 50,000 people at the game and thousands of people, I'm assuming, having tailgates. Okay.
Right. And our contention is that with thousands of people, and especially in this particular game, which was a sellout, TCU had an obligation to at least hire a single patrol officer to patrol Lot 2, and they didn't do so. So essentially, TCU is making the argument, wait a second, we have 50,000 people at this football game. We're allowing alcohol consumption outside in the tailgating area, and we're not going to assign a single patrol officer. We're also going to let all the CSC event staff leave at 9:30 p.m. before the game even ended. And therefore, there's no security whatsoever assigned to that lot. I mean, it's, to me...
Do we have any evidence of other incidents that day? I mean, proof's in the pudding. If there were 150 incidents that day, that would tell me, aha, maybe TCU should have known something was going on. And if there's one incident that day, that tells me that, okay, they were right. TCU is a sedate crowd. Nothing goes on.
Well,
or do, is there any of that in the record?
We had the trial court overruled a piece of evidence or ruled against a piece of evidence.
That evidence, if there is any, is not before us.
It's not before the court.
All right.
The evidence that we do have again is that Sergeant Stripmatter testified that.
Well, your time is almost up, so if you want to address something real quickly about from Mr. Bettinger, maybe you better go ahead and do it if that's not what you're doing.
I think that in response to the I was responding that there wasn't a scintilla of evidence on the Timberwalk factors. I believe there was. I believe that the officer, Sergeant Stripmatter, he testified, again, there were one to two arrests per game. And then in response to Mr. Bettinger's argument that this was the pot boiling and that this 90 minutes of recurring hostilities was necessary, I don't read that that's the way Del Lago ruled on this matter. In fact, Del Lago specifically stated that a long and continued course of conduct, and it put it in brackets, is not required to find that the proprietor had knowledge of the violent disposition of the other patron. All that is necessary is there be a sequence of conduct sufficiently long to enable the proprietor to act for the patron's safety. In this instance, there were two prior incidences that we presented evidence of, and 30 minutes before the final assault. Clearly, TCU had long enough time to enable TCU to act and at least assign a single officer to the gate. The O'Briens testified they went straight through the gate, the entrance to Lot 2, unimpeded, after two prior incidences, and the testimony revealed these were the only incidences going on that day. So I would submit to the court that appellant has brought a scintilla of evidence on both Del Lago and Timberwalk. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your arguments. Your case is submitted, and we will now take a 25-minute break until 3 o'clock when we will hear our third oral argument for the day.